morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Down to Brass Tacks. Today is the fifth day of the fifth month, 2020. And my name is Peter Wakeham. Good to be with you for another day, another round of conversation on the program we call Brass Tacks. Our number one producer is in the chair, Mr. Dennis Johnson. He's back from his sabbatical and refreshed, revivified, and re-energized and ready to tackle the likes of Anti-America, who I understand is going to be my first call today. So we're here with you until 2 p.m. We normally have a very vigorous debate and discussion and conversation over the course of the morning. Our call number is 434-1790. You can email me at peter.w.wickham@gmail.com. You can also WhatsApp us on 233-IVOB. Those are the ways you can reach us. And of course, the conversation will be wide-ranging. This is the day after the reintroduction of alcoholic beverages. This is day two. My understanding is that day one went well. People were equally enthusiastic about access to the beach for a short time and access to alcohol for a long time. So that matter is settled. I have not heard a report from the Czar regarding the extent to which social distancing was observed. For my own part, I moved around a little bit yesterday, not to buy alcohol, but for other reasons, legitimate reasons, I should add. And I did notice that the social distancing principles were observed, as they have been, I think, for the most part. My concern was the ZR vans. I found too many of the ZR vans appeared to be crowded. Too many of the operators of those ZR vans especially were not wearing masks. Many of the conductors were not wearing masks. I thought that was particularly offensive that the conductors who are interacting with passengers are not wearing masks. And then in many instances, I saw more people on those ZR vans than should have been there. So the idea of them operating at 50% occupancy was something that was not happening. The B vans, the yellow ones, seem to have been a little better at maintaining the rules and regulations. And of course, the transport board buses, as always, were able to do better in that regard. So I did have some amount of concern regarding the use of social distancing regarding the ZR vans. And I wonder whether that might not be a special interest that was taken. But otherwise, we seem to be moving in the right direction regarding our ability to manage this crisis. Globally, there were some conversations that took place. My people in Italy are telling me that there has been an ease in the restrictions somewhat, and they are be able to breathe outdoor fresh air for the first time, which is certainly welcome. United States of America, some of us feel, has gotten carried away. But that's where we are, and I believe this will be the eighth week of this crisis being identified as a pandemic, and we're hopefully seeing the end of the crisis somewhere in sight. Certainly not here yet, but certainly somewhere in sight. So we hope that things will continue to go well. My concern this morning very briefly relates to the Guyana situation. Of course, when COVID started, Guyana was with us. And sadly, as COVID continues into the eighth week, Guyana is still with us. And those ballots have not been counted. Yesterday, there was agreement that a CARICOM team led by, I believe it will be Cynthia Barrow-Giles, will be leading a CARICOM team of three people that will oversee the recount. I was speaking yesterday to one of the operatives in Guyana, and they were expressing concern about the management of this count and the fact that there was a disinclination to live stream the count, which is what people felt would really be the best opportunity to ensure a level of transparency. So there's an objection to live streaming, and it looks as though we will go with supervised counts taking place in several places. They continue to argue over minute details. It continues to be obvious to me that GCOM does not have a genuine interest in having a recount done, and certainly GCOM would be the best agency to explain the reasons why they are so hesitant to have those ballots open and have what is inside counted, because they are uncomfortable with, or likely to be uncomfortable with the outcome. I still am not understanding why the recount cannot be confined to the one region that is problematic, and let's have the recount there, since there is agreement regarding the statement of polls for all the other ones. I'm also curious to know why it is not possible to just have the original statement of poll, which is in the actual ballot box, produced and tabulated as an interim measure to just ensure that those counts are accurate before we actually go to a recount. These are some of the questions that I have continued to have challenges with. And as I said, I think in terms of Guyana, there is a clear indication to me that there are agencies that would really prefer not to have those ballots counted for reasons best known to themselves. So that's where we are. I hope that by the end of this week, there will be some movement in that regard. So we go straight to the first call, and I say good morning and welcome to Mr. Anti America, fresh back from a sabbatical himself, and he is ready to take on the issues of the day. Good morning, sir, and how are you?
Oh, boy. What an introduction, man.
Well, you know, we have to herald your arrival. My only concern is I don't have dancing monkeys that I can impose on the radio.
You are creating...
We look forward to hearing you, you know. Huh? We look forward to hearing you.
I see that now. So you putting a target on people unnecessarily, man. No, can't even leave the house for the next 5 or 6 weeks. What are you doing that to me, man?
Well, that's good because you shouldn't be leaving anyhow. You shouldn't be leaving anyhow.
I was on the beach like everybody else. I'm sorry.
Okay.
With my bottle of rum in my hand. I didn't even spot you. I went down South Coast. I was looking to see if you would come out. But.
No, I can't swim, you know, so I don't go to the beach.
You can't swim?
I can't swim. You see, I got a back door.
A Barbadian, to admit that in public, requires a lot of courage, my man. You know, I respect you.
A lot of Barbadians can't swim. That's actually a study that should be done someday.
Not the majority. Yeah, look, I just really want to reiterate, okay? Mm-hmm. Because this crisis that we have now is not the first. We have had, every 10 years or so, just throw some man-made foolishness at you. And you got to find a way to get by, you know, post 9/11 and post 2008. They will find something to come at you with, some manufacturers. And when they say they, I really don't know who these they are, but I know they're not acts of God, that's for sure. Telling people to shut down the quarantine. No, I do not, but that's another matter.
Okay, the question of an act of God is not relevant for you.
No, by the legal term. So, you know, it has a meaning. It has a meaning, not necessarily a belief in anything. But truth be told, the response to COVID was very much mad. And you can't even prove that it came from bats. They don't know the connection between the pangolin and the human being. They don't know. They're just guessing at these things. So even my assessment that is created or man-made or something is still valid. Mm. But it doesn't matter. The response to it is indeed man-made. And it always results in a catastrophe for developing countries all the time. We can't print money and say, well, our money got international standing, so we can do this and we can buy stuff with our own money from overseas. We can't do that. But you would think that after trial number one, which is 2000, trial number two, which is 2008, we would get it right when they say we are talking about Barbados as a national agenda, as a national policy, as a response to these things. But it never seems to happen. It doesn't matter which party is in. Of course, the same voices always come to the fore and make the same comments and stuff. But the response over the last 10 years really truly hasn't been that much. I have to admit, but that sounds political. But truth be told, it still was not what it's supposed to be, nor is this one. There are a lot of countries, a few of them, not a lot, that survived because they rely on themselves. The central theme is self-reliance. How can you rely on yourself? To feed yourself, to produce and provide for yourself, and in so doing, produce and provide for others, to sell to the region, to sell to the world. First, provide for yourself. Self-reliance. And that never seems to come out past the lips of Clyde Maskell. You know, I understand. When you go to lending agencies, now I'll tell the truth, the IMF and the World Bank and these guys, and particularly the IMF, never really have a policy. They don't have a track record. They don't have the history of supporting the countries in the region or third world country in a manner that would help for them to develop their capacities, you know, to become self-reliant. You know, they destroyed Jamaica in the 70s because Manley was very self-reliant. You know, we could produce our own stuff. But he had to go to these guys for help. And the guys tell him, well, let me tell you, you got to shut down that, and that. I start importing this, and this from you know who. Or you can't get the money out of us. And Manley, I think he's dead now, would have died a very broken human being. You deal with these guys, you go and ask for their money, and they will respond to you in a manner that says you cannot do certain things. They're going to say so outright, but they will not encourage you to be self-reliant. You will have to be more dependent on international input, you know, having investors be confident in your in your stability and confident in your consumers and confident in your consultants to help them out when they want a little taxation relief and that kind of thing, but not confident that Barbados can actually produce something that the rest of the world can buy. There's a significant difference between the two. Yes, it's all about confidence, but there has to be a confidence in Barbadians and indeed Caribbean people to provide to the rest of the world too.
Do you think that
the IMF is not about that?
Do you think that we are at a good point where we could rejig, I think that's the word that they use, rejig the Barbados economy and orient ourselves more towards selling the type of product that you're talking about than selling the type of product that we have traditionally sold, which is tourism?
I used to, up to about 4 weeks ago, consider tourism a product because I define product as the combination of a number of services. You put a number of services together and the ultimate result becomes a product. A service as opposed to just one service providing a service, a product is a combination. That is how I defined product, and therefore tourism became one. But then I realized, if there are people who don't come to Barbados, boy, we can't sell them nothing. So I have to treat tourism separately because tourism requires for them to come here in order for them to experience whatever this product is. So I can't really be dealing with tourism no more.
So my question is, what would it take for us to achieve this turn, to turn this corner that you're talking about?
The product, as I would have liked for Miss Motley to have understood, and she understood. She says, I understand art and I agree with you. I heard that. I got it on recording.
Who's saying art?
I don't know. Somebody that was speaking on my behalf.
Okay.
And I agree with you.
This name comes up a lot when I'm chatting with you. This art.
I understand. I don't know who's this name, art. He's a next door neighbor. And let's get him in trouble because he sounds the same as me.
Okay.
He got the same voice. Mm-hmm. And the point apparently was made.
But he's a fairly ugly fella though, this art. Isn't he?
No, I understand he's a very good looking guy though. Seriously.
Okay.
Like tall, good looking guy, man.
Huh? It might be differences of opinion where that is concerned. He has an attractive wife, I must tell you.
Is that the voice of jealousy or otherwise? That's not genuine to me at all, but come on, you could do better than that there. Listen, man, look, if you are going to be a product provider, you first need a sales force. Starcom Network will not be here today. Starcom provides, a product because it offends, it doesn't offend your ear. Come on. Mm-hmm. that slipped out. Starcom provides something that is supposed to be tangible. You can hear it. It is a product, and it has to be sold to the advertisers. Without a sales department, there will be no Starcom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, for Barbados to become a product or product producer or provider of whatever the rest of the world can get, it needs a sales force. We do not have a sales force, and our lack of performance over the past 60 years has been as a result of a lack of a sales force. But that is straightforward. You cannot provide anything, you cannot produce anything, you cannot be a representative of any market without somebody out there to sell. You need to have salespeople. You need to employ them. You need to put them in strategic positions where they can actually interact, develop markets, they can actually see opportunities, and they can actually speak pretty enough to have doors open so that people can actually buy the things that you have to sell them. And that's
but you know, the only difficulty I'm having with what you're saying
you
is that...
You have difficulty with that, man, Peter? Come on.
No, I don't have a difficulty with it because it's something that we got to do. The difficulty I'm having is that I believe this is what we have been doing all along. We have been marketing. We've been selling Barbados.
No. We have been... Let me go through the Barbados building up there in Warren. They do a lot of marketing. They claim by just buying advertising. It requires a bit more than that. And the people who actually do the selling for Barbados are not even Barbados. There are people who... Or the travel agents around the world. They're the ones who actually engage the public and tell them, come. If you need to have a sales job, then you need to employ a salesperson. You just can't employ an executive or a sweet sounding.
But don't we have a team? We have teams in the London market, the European market, the American market.
Yeah, identify them.
But don't we have teams? You have marketing teams, the tourism teams.
But even if they have one, you are still only selling tourism. You still stand in.
So you want BMA to have marketing teams there too?
I want Barbados to be marketed. I want all that Barbados can provide the rest of the world to be marketed and sold in the same manner. And in order to do that, you first have to know what it is that we can do. Well, you can't go in there and sell something if you don't know what it is you're selling. So there's absolutely no indication that there's any interest in what Barbados could provide to the rest of the world because there was never a survey coming around and saying, well, hey, excuse me, my man, but what is that you do? What is that you do that we can actually get involved in and help to sell to overseas? Nobody never asked you that there. You need first to understand that there's a database that has to be developed. That database has to have all the names and all the addresses and all the people who can actually produce something that the rest of the world can possibly buy in time. And also those who have a potential to do something that the rest of the world can buy, and also the ability to create markets that Barbados can actually facilitate in some time. Mm-hmm. We produce a lot of stuff here in Barbados, you know. We really do. More than just hotel room, hotel space. And again, they can't really incorporate them no more because unless people can travel here to Barbados, they may not use. They may not use. So you got to be dealing with them, with the manufacturers and the producers separately, mm-hmm. whether it's music, whether it's recipes, whether it is produce out of the ground, or you know, whether it is the cultural industries that lady mentioned on Sunday. I have to admit, you know, these people always sound so much better when they're opposition. When you're in opposition, you talk real sense, you know. When you get in the government, you don't talk sense no more. But when you realize that the cultural industries have been producing people who have been providing, you know, a product to the rest of the world for years upon years, and with very little recognition, to be honest with you, you have to understand that they need to be sold to everybody else, not only sea, sun, and sand. You know, if you've got to spend $67 million in marketing, market everybody, sell everybody, and left out the tourism alone, because the tourism is fickle at best, and you recognize that they are going to be subject to these shocks, these man-made shocks every 10 years. I wonder what will come in 2029. Mm-hmm. In 10 years, then it will come with something different. And then you have to be self-reliant. And self-reliant also means having a sales force, not a marketing team, a sales force that is supported by a marketing team that will get you through the doors. I mean, that is a simple, that is a straightforward. You know, I've been saying that for about 25 years now. Mm-hmm. Huh?
I am not at odds with what you're saying. I feel that the crisis has highlighted certain things that we need to do. I think that we all agree for a long time that our economy has been able to stand on one leg precariously for too long.
Two legs.
Well,
and
tourism.
The offshore business.
But right, you know, yeah. I mean that one started to contract in 2008. So basically, we have been standing on a leg, and we need to do something about that. The challenge that we would always have is in terms of the mechanism that we adopt to bring about those changes. And I am not opposed to us selling a different type of product, even as I am a person who essentially sells an intangible, one could argue, a product, because I sell information. But I acknowledge that there needs to be a focus on the kind of product that your friend Art is interested in, which I don't have a problem with. My question is the how. And I heard Don Marshall, and I know he's a big fan of yours, speaking over the weekend and talking about the fact that this is a time to rejig and all of these things. And I find that the language is nice. My challenge is when it comes to how, that's usually where it falls apart.
I gave you a how.
You're talking about marketing, and the marketing
I'm talking about, I like marketers and stuff. I think mm-hmm. marketers are very important when it comes particularly to developing markets and stuff, but you need people who can actually get out there and open them up. Mm-hmm. You know, people who actually go out there, encourage people to come and talk. You know, when those guys come and interface with the tourism people, they go through the tourist reps, the agricultural minister's one. Mm-hmm. Was it? You know, the airline people, the tourists.
You mean Indar?
Yeah, my good friend Indar, right. You know, when you go through, those are the guys, not Indar. Indar is reversed. Indar brings people, sells overseas to Barbados, but to Barbadians. But those guys from overseas will sell Barbados to the people overseas. Mm. And they are not Barbados. I'm just saying they're only dealing with the tourism and the traveling and that kind of thing. But they are also selling the rest of the world as well, too, of which Barbados is only one. You need people who specialize in Barbados. Barbados got a special kind of sugar cane that package a certain way that we can sell across there in Europe. Let me get some people on the ground and get these things in shops. If you're going to be paying people U.S. money to do stuff, and we pay a lot of people money to stay in overseas agencies, those people should be selling left, right, and center, to the point where it doesn't cost Barbados anything to keep those agencies open. Do you know the U.S. embassy doesn't cost the Americans anything?
All right, quick question before we go. The guy here is saying to me that marijuana could be a product, tourism is a product, and art is also a product. Ask Arturo which would be more efficient at this time, in his opinion. So you have ganja, you have art, and you have tourism. Which is the...
You know, you know, you got passports too. Do you know how people are selling passports? That's why, and they call it diplomatic status.
Okay.
They are picking at the lowest hanging fruit in order to survive. Mm. Do you really think that after all of these years of free education that we got to be going after low hanging fruit?
Yeah, fair enough.
You really think so? Come on, man. All right.
The ganja industry is one that is another, there's another long conversation that we have to have now. Ganja industry post-COVID. How is the ganja industry going to look post-COVID?
Yeah, but ganja is agricultural. I mean, if you want to go that route, by all means, by all means, it's agricultural, it's production. And
my challenge with it is that I think that there are people who overestimate the demand for that product.
Yes,
in the context of, right, where you don't have tourists coming in to sell ganja to, and you have a local market, and it's a product that is relatively easy to grow in the manufacturing involved.
The price falls.
Precisely, the price falls. Got everybody growing a tree or two in the backyard, and I mean, for the average person, you can't smoke all of that. So,
oh, you're not so good.
Well, I mean, there's one of my friends that are in the business tell me, right?
Oh. Okay.
And actually, I was speaking to some friends who are in the same business, and I was asking them what was the market looking like during the whole shutdown.
Oh, these are friends overseas, not in Barbados.
Overseas friends.
Oh, right, yeah, okay.
Not Barbadian friends.
No, not Barbados. No.
But they tell me that apparently people were buying in bulk.
No,
in the same way that they're stocking up on other things, they're stocking up on the ganja as well. So the sales were actually more predictable because it wasn't a little one thing and a two thing. It was, you're buying a large quantity to hold you over for the 2-week lockdown.
But this is outside of Barbados.
So it's outside of Barbados. But seriously though, this is a thing that unless you have a capacity to export that product, like you're selling it for medicinal purposes, or you have tourists coming in that want to try the Barbados Hydro, as they call it, the Bajan Hydro, you're going to run into a situation where there's a glut on the market, the price falls, and nobody ain't making the money from it. Everybody growing it.
You know? I am impressed by your level of knowledge on this particular
thank you. I read widely.
You may have a very personal
stake. I read widely.
Okay. I'm
all right.
Very good.
All right. Good chatting with you, sir. We're going to run. I have note here from someone who is asking about the situation in Bastyr. What's up with the opposition in St. Kitts holding an anti-lockdown protest in Bastyr? Are they being influenced by American rights? I also saw that, as far as I know, it wasn't an anti-lockdown protest. It was like a political rally that they were holding in contravention of the state of emergency. My sense is that the opposition was attempting to make a point. The march was being led by Denzel Douglas, who is no longer a member of parliament. I'm quite frankly looking forward to see what action the state takes in this regard, because it was a flagrant violation of the state of emergency. There was no, even though I guess one could argue that they tried to maintain some level of social distancing, I can't see how the police could have given permission for that march to go ahead. And it boggles the mind as to why the opposition would think that that's something that they need to do now, other than to be able to prove that they can do what they want to do. And that's something that the government needs to take a dim view on. Donna Brastocks, good morning.
Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Wickham.
Morning, sir. How are you doing?
Not too bad, yourself?
Good. Not too bad.
Somebody just sent a WhatsApp message here to me and tell me that the last caller, Mr. Anti-America, when you listen to him, it reminds you of a role that you're asking Raw to play. Go to the piano, play a piece by Frederick Chopin, the Fantasy C major.
Mm-hmm.
And he says very annoying to the ears that sometimes Mr. Anti-America.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow,
he ain't the only one. They got a lot of people that call that annoy other callers. So
I know that.
So
anyhow, let me go on to what.
So you barely waste your time telling me that,
But let me go on to. Mm-hmm. I heard the minister of agriculture talking about this. We have a gold mine here in Sea Island Cotton. We have a gold mine, right? It is fact that. When you say your CIA cotton as the raw product to the places that buy Japan or some people, they're the people making money off of the CIA cotton. Like you will get some US dollars for it. But then when that product is finished, it costs a lot of money. So it's true that we have a gold mine, but not for Barbados, it's for Japan and other people. And then remember the agriculture, a gentleman for the agriculture said that we should have the exchange that we could take this raw material. I refine it and make the finished product, and everything remains in Barbados. If we don't do that, we are doing nothing.
Which is a reasonable and unreasonable point, but what's the problem with Sea Island cotton?
No. He said that we are going to make this X amount of money.
Right. And what is the problem there in terms of the chain? What's the challenge that they've been having with Sierra Leone cotton and that industry?
I was met almost 10 years ago. The challenge is firstly to get labor.
Right, precisely. So you can start the conversation, you can start right there. Unless you can find someone to harvest that cotton, your point about production locally, your point about the byproducts, the fact that you can use it to make other products and you can develop an industry, all of that is good. But in order to do that, you have to get it off the pods. Who is going to take it off the pods?
At least some years ago, it was so ridiculous that you were working in the hot sun and a 1 pound Sierra Leone cotton was $2.50 a pound. Now, tell me how many people will go out there so they pick Sierra Leone cotton at $2.50 a pound.
So what would you suggest your rate be?
I don't have an idea, but I would say that you have to pay them a peer study of attractive price that when people go there, at the end of the day, they can see what they're doing.
But if you pay too attractive a price for it, then it makes your product difficult to sell.
No, but if the people in Japan want it, they will pay the money because those people like it and they will pay the money.
Yeah, but they're not going to pay anything for it.
That is true, too. But you don't have to scare it to $10 or $15. You can pay $5-$7 a pound. That's I would say reasonable.
I am saying to you, sir, that I think that your comment and your intervention is well intentioned, and I appreciate that you're coming from a good place. But I also am fully aware of the challenges that one encounters with labor in these kinds of situations. Look at what's happening in the United Kingdom now. Because of the COVID and because of their attitude towards immigrants and so on, you now have a situation where British people are being asked to harvest asparagus and other products. And apparently they said they needed 6,000 workers and they got like 1,000. And I'm saying even under these circumstances where people are unemployed in large numbers, you know, they're just not interested in going out and doing that type of work. And I would say the same thing to you as well, that until you can solve that labor problem, and you're not going to solve it by paying people $5 a pound. Because if you pay them too much to harvest the product, then it makes the product extremely expensive. And your view that Japan will buy it at any cost is a view that I don't necessarily support. If it becomes uncompetitive, no one is going to be interested in buying it.
That is also true, too. But we see what happened later when you go for there. Now, my last point to you is that some time ago, we were talking, I heard you mention of what the DLP should or what the DLP should not do to come back. Your advice to the Democratic Labour Party, will you really think that the Democratic Labour Party leadership at this stage need your advice?
No, but they don't need it. They never needed it. So, ain't a problem.
Have you ever run for a political party?
Who, me?
Yeah.
No.
Oh. George Bell ran for political organization that sometimes...
People something. But what's the point you're making, though? So you think that neither of us are in a position to advise the Democratic Labour Party?
No, I'm not saying that you can advise. But I'm telling you that if you had a political organization, and you know all these things, I am sure that if you run, let's say, St. Michael's Central, it would be difficult. It would be hard for you to even get 100 votes. Although you on the other hand could tell the Baptist and the Democrats what they should or what.
But what's the point you're making?
The point I'm making that you are in no position to advise the president of the Democrats.
But then a problem. She could ignore me. But she's ignoring me anyhow. It's pretty clear.
Yes.
Right. And then a problem.
And you're still
sir. Look. Let's end this conversation here. You and the Democratic Labour Party and the Dems have no obligation to listen to me, to George Bell, to anybody. And if really the PC wants to dismiss anything I have said, she can do so. If you don't believe I'm qualified to offer advice, that's fine. I don't work for you, right? I'm fortunate that there are a few people knocking around this region that will pay me for my opinion. Right? And that keeps me in business, and for that I am very grateful. If you are not one of those people who believe my advice is useful, then fine, just dismiss it. Easy. You ain't got to call on the program and make an issue of it. So anything I say regarding the DLP that you all believe should be ignored, ignore it. Because it's pretty obvious that you're not listening to me anyhow. So you think the DLP is in good shape now? What he put down? Okay, he gone. All right, let's see. I just love my Dems. Huh? Good morning and welcome. You're on the air. 434-1790 is the number to call. Remember, we're here until 2 p.m. Myself and Dennis Johnson, fresh back from his Midsummer's Night dream. Down to brass tacks. Good morning.
Morning, Peter.
Morning, sir. How are you doing? Glenn, how's it good to hear you?
Good to hear you, too.
Yeah.
First of all, it's good to hear Mr. Antimarica back on the air.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a provocative style. And there are a couple of things I want to talk to him about, particularly. I mentioned to you some weeks ago, discussed of the registration of political parties. You know, that used to be one of his. I've come around to the point of view that that's something we should explore some more.
Mm-hmm.
But and also, what you were talking about, he was talking about tourism as a product, and you were talking about selling information. At one time, those things, particularly tourism, used to be described as an invisible export.
Mm-hmm.
So it was seen as a kind of product, but it was seen as an invisible, intangible one. But it was a product nevertheless. But I want to talk to you about something completely different, really. I have 2 points I hope I get time to make. The
sure,
one is that. Okay, this I don't know if you saw the news maybe a week or so ago, less than a week, under a week, the We Care program initiative is being launched by the Ministry of Tourism with an uncle minister, Kerry Simmons, in which they are trying to award frontier workers. There'll be a competition to award frontier workers for their work through a tourism competition. And get a staycation, vacation, other parts of one, another prize and whatnot. I am all for awarding, rewarding, acknowledging, supporting our friend care workers. I think they're doing an outstanding job. As a matter of fact, I've gone beyond just saying, don't just clap them up. I think they should get a financial bonus tax fee at the end of the exercise or towards the end of the exercise. I think they should be protected by then they're financed by insurance. And I also feel that. That bonus should be equal across the board, no matter what your status is, a job and hierarchy. It's a team, and every man was invited to the team, and therefore everybody should get the same thing. And also, I feel that I also propose that they could be given some award which they can wear on their uniforms forever, some like Defender of Barbados. So I'm going beyond that. But I feel that to introduce a competition cheapens the whole process, because we regard them as. Every day, they're heroes. Every day, they're performing hero acts. And therefore, to introduce this thing of a competition as though it's based to the world or something like that, I feel it demeans it, defeats it. Because heroism, the term heroism, really involves, captures some of the highest ideals of society. That's why we have national heroes. When you're a hero, you are above the ordinary person. To me, unless you're a national hero, to me, you're just one step below being a god. So I'm saying it's a real refined atmosphere, and therefore you see that to force them into it as though it's some kind of commodity, some kind of object. You'll be familiar with those terms, because the feminist talk about the commodification of women and the objectification of women. I think a quite a noble exercise, a gesture, an attitude, a spirit, right, an outlook, behavior, action. I think it's the to do it great harm, but I would like to. I'm afraid. I'm not impressed by it. And I think that I think it should be rethought.
All right, no problem. You were another point you said you wanted to make.
Yeah, the other one I want to make is this question of the. I noticed the Barbados Association of Journalists and Media Workers, which hadn't been in the news in the last few years, but now in the news quite fairly often. They are saying that they have an award ceremony which is going to be held in November, and it's going to be sponsored by the U.S. Embassy. Now, journalists, I'm not sure if they understand the possible implications, how that could be used against them, how it could tarnish their image and reputation of impartiality, objectivity, being hands length with the government. Would they have accepted if the government or Barbados want to sponsor their award ceremony? And as far as they know, the Barbadian public is not clamoring for awards for journalism. They're clamoring for good journalism, accurate journalism, good grammar, good spelling. I saw in the paper today, one paper there where somebody talked about forecasted. Mm-hmm. When he was growing up, you taught broadcast and forecast or comment, where you there's no ED as their path. You forecast or broadcast. I don't forecast it. I saw it the other day.
There's a catch in there, though, because when you get sponsorship from someone, it gives you the opportunity to spread your word beyond a particular locale. So if you have sponsorship, maybe you can have your activities in a different environment. You can, you know, have better awards. You can, you know, essentially you can reach more people. And when you think about it, Glenn, it's no different to what the average journalists do. We here at VOB, we sell a product, which is this program. and people advertise on this product. The important thing is that a person who is sponsoring has to understand that they cannot control your editorial content. So if you don't like Peter Wickham and you don't like what Peter Wickham says, you cannot attempt to achieve a particular objective in terms of your own business by saying, well, I'm going to take away my sponsorship. I always use as an example the Sunday program, Sunday Brass Tacks, that's sponsored by Williams Industries. And from time to time, we have taken positions that have been contrary to the views of that entity, but they don't take away the sponsorship. I mean, and that was the lesson that my grandfather fought to uphold many years ago, and you would know about that whole issue. So I don't know if I agree with you, because I think that you got to take sponsorship from someone. Perhaps they wouldn't take it from government. But if they are taking it from an entity that understands that you are sponsoring journalists, a journalistic endeavor, but it doesn't mean that you can control the output.
No, if you had a combination of sponsors, I could bet. But I think that given the behavior of the Americans, the reputation of the Americans, there's no such thing as a freelancer, as they say, to coin their phrase. Mm. I think it's different selling a newscast, an organization. I think that I grew up in the era in Spoonerville, when the men in the Ramshot would tell you, if you can't buy, don't buy. If you can't afford a ram, don't trust, don't inconvenience yourself. I think it's a danger. I think it opens them to a lot of challenges and doubts about the Peter. I don't mean to embarrass you or inconvenience, but you remember the WikiLeaks episode where your name were linked with the Americans. True, from what I understand, you merely attended events and spoke to them or interacted with them, and then your name was used.
Right, you know? But that ain't the problem. But they had a lot of other journalists there too. They used my name, but they had other journalists there too.
But I can only go by.
Right, I understand that. But I am saying that if it was that I was wrong to speak in those environments, then can you is there?
No, I wasn't saying that at all. I know you.
What you were saying?
I am saying that these things can be taken and spun and twist it in a particular way to do harm to people and their reputation.
Yeah, but at the same time, Glenn, right? The other side of it is something that I would equally argue. Right? The opportunities that have been afforded by the American Embassy, not only in terms of sponsoring this event, right? They sent me to a very useful exercise as alumnus or whatever it is, where I watched the one election. I think it was the re-election of George Bush, right? Kamar Jordan did one too, and several other people from the media have been and they have done those things. Apparently Dennis Johnson did one as well.
Right? I'm familiar with that.
Right. No, the point I am making is that the benefits that you derive from that level of interaction, to me, it more than outweighs the potential harm that can be done, like in a WikiLeaks situation.
But Peter, when you go on a fellowship or something like that,
right.
you're open to ideas and different influences. Or when you are sponsored,
Glenn, I'm just making the point that your use of that example, I think, is off, because the example demonstrates that, you know, I got a hard hit from that. I ain't gonna tell you no lie. But the point is still that there are other journalists who have made use of those facilities, and I'm saying that the American government is a sponsor of many of these types of things. I appreciate that in many instances they have an objective that you have to watch. But I also believe there can be considerable benefit that can be gained by taking that level of sponsorship, especially in times when money is so tight. But Glenn, we're going to have to run though, because Dennis is telling me that we need to take a break. Thanks for the interaction. Down to Brass Tacks. Remember, we're on 434-1790, and you can call us. You can email me at peter.w.wickham@gmail.com. Say good morning. Welcome to Down to Brass Tacks to the next caller.
Good morning. Usually, well, welcome me to the program or that. Just
I'm always welcoming you. I'm happy to hear.
I call it to talk my usual foolishness, right? No, I don't know when you were growing up. If you heard about a kite called a singing angel?
A singing angel? Yeah, I hear about that.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. That was a kite that was surrounded. It was a round kite surrounded by bulls.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to be scared out at night.
You know who was the kite champ in my childhood days at primary school? No less a person than the former Honorable Christopher Sinclair. He was the kite champ, so he knew all about every single kite there was. He knew about, and the singing angel is one that I heard him talk about. I find it an extremely annoying kite, quite frankly. No. I can't tell you that I want to see one of those kites ever again.
My concern is...
Because it's bulls all around. Is this a kite designed to make noise? And there's nothing angelic about that kind of noise.
I wonder sometimes if some of us reach old age, if it's suddenly become foolish. Because a lot of people, I heard Mark Cohen warn your kite should not have bulls.
Mm-hmm.
But that's partly fun. Now,
it's fun for you.
Children. Hold on, please. Sorry. We flew kites. We had them here. Oh. Right? All of a sudden now, obviously you would have grown. You would have reached seniorhood. But now you're campaigning. Right? I think the appropriate thing to do is to limit the flying of kites. I remember as a child growing up, kites used to be flown a week before Easter and a week after Easter. I don't want to appear not to sympathize with people. But then again, you can't always criticize. I remember reading a paper article, a resident within the confinements, if you can call that, at the hockey stadium, said that the hockey lights should be turned off because it does annoy planes when the pilots men are coming in to land. I mean, that was so ridiculous. Right? Now, in response, I had a caller. Talk about transport for sending buses to St. Lucie with a few people. Now, which would he rather? Send a transport board big bus to St. Lucie with about 6 people, or a small transport bus with about 30 people? The whole thing is about social distancing. Of course, you cannot get the required distance on the bus. And speaking about that, if we are really serious about this social distancing, I have said it before, twice on the program. I went so far as to call the CEO. He told me the final decision does not lie with him. No one should be allowed on a bus or minibus, whatever, unless they're wearing a mask.
Yeah.
I personally feel that when you come out of your house, you should be wearing a mask. If you're not wearing that mask, I feel you should be arrested and locked up.
Arrested is a strong
because
word.
This thing is, we again a criminal record. If there's a video circulation with Taiwan on how they handled it, and this is how they handled it, the country are not being locked down. Things have been going on as normal, but everybody is practicing social distancing and every person is wearing a mask. The video was sent to me, right, about the water wars in St. John. I spoke to a number of residents and the affected areas, and they feel it's grossly unfair that you are not getting water, but yet you're being sent bills the more as if you were getting water.
Mm.
And not only that, you're being threatened with disconnection. That is wrong. I think one of the ways we can solve our water problems in those affected areas, put in more and bigger tanks that we need to do. I'm not going to blame no politician, whether they or be, for not getting water. What the brain of for is not making the proper arrangements so people can have access to water. That's what I would blame them for. And another thing that concerns me, in this distress that people are going through, are we still sending water to tourist boats? And the people that owe water authority, millions, have any threatening letters been sent to them? Why are we always looking to pick on the small man? Why? I heard that certain hotels, I'm going to call the name, owe millions to Water Authority. They have a person from Water Authority on this calling program some time ago. When they queried it, tell me if it turned off the water, it would affect the tourist industry. So when you turn off people water, who's not getting the water, it ain't going to affect them either.
Mm-hmm.
It is wrong. And I think something needs to be done about it. My last point. Hello?
Go ahead, Mr. P. Make your point, please.
My last point. In fact, I can left off on that thing.
All right, Mr. Peep. Thank you. Thank you for your contribution. I appreciate very much hearing from you. This is Dr. Brastax. I have a caller. WhatsApp is telling me that he supports the Democratic Labour Party, and he believes I have every right to offer opinions, and there's nothing wrong with my giving advice, which can be dismissed if necessary. We need to get it right as a party. And I want to thank you, sir, for saying that. There are Dems and there are Dems, and there are Dems that believe that my opinion has no relevance to them, and there are Dems who want to hear my opinion, and I have no difficulty with both types of Dems. So as I said, you know, if you are a Dem that believes that the Wickham or the Bellevue is irrelevant, then just ignore it. It's easy. Dr. Brastax, good afternoon.
Good morning, Peter.
Morning, sir. Morning. Sorry, not afternoon.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Did you read the book?
Got your rum yesterday.
Okay. Good.
I didn't get to read the book yet. But
yeah. All right, now let me
go. I asked you if you got your rum yesterday.
Me?
Mm-hmm.
I don't drink alcohol no more.
Oh, okay. Will you stop?
Long time.
Where you stop?
It became an enemy to me.
Really? Because you drink too much or the wrong thing?
Well, I am one of those people. I lost a dear loving friend through alcohol.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, good. Now let me go on. Let me say this morning to our Prime Minister. I wish her well. And I will say this. Now, anytime I speak about her, she know me better than you know me, personally. So I just try not even to call her name when I deal with politics. I try to deal with issues. I don't deal with personalities. Now, I was very glad this morning when I heard you mention about your grandfather. COVID, like it caused you to blow your own trumpet, because you can't blow nobody else at this time. Good? So talking about your grandfather is a relief to me, because I always quote the gallant effort that your grandfather did. Well, this morning, I really want to talk about RB culture. And I listen and watch. COVID had put me in a position where I spent a lot of time watching TV, not when listening to radio and reading. And I listened to Agriculture Sunday night. And it is refreshing to hear some of the things that came up. Did you start that program on Sunday night, The People's Business?
No, I did not, unfortunately.
It did not. But it was amazing, you know, because the host, Peter Thorne, and you can laugh at this one. Then he opened up the program. He said, well, this is the time you're dealing with agriculture, but at the same thing, a lot of people in this country know drop shepherd and eating healthy. Now, when he said that, I said to myself, I wonder if people don't understand what he's speaking. Because if you're talking about productivity in agriculture, chickens is a part of agriculture. So if you reduce the eating of chicken, it means that the farmers who raise chicken will be at a disadvantage. Well, I know you will laugh this one this morning on the advertisement I heard, is that the people are not buying pork. So they got to reduce the price. I know you love that.
But they had a pork plant in the U.S. that shut down completely.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Now, let me go on.
Outbreak of coronavirus, so they couldn't get enough workers.
Yeah,
so they had
you love that.
A lot of pigs get saved.
You are triumphant this morning when you hear the pork price.
I would be glad if they start eating chicken too. But,
yeah,
you know, little by little.
Now, you know why I am concerned?
Mm-hmm.
I kept on this air speaking about agriculture and the supply of water. You would be surprised to hear the minister's statement. When they speak about St. John, you remember last time I was on the air, I spoke about John the Baptist and the water.
Right.
And if you look in the Bible, there's so many times that important people were met at wells in the Bible. Jesus Christ met the lady at the well. Moses met a lady at a well. All those sort of things. I said before.
Who is that Jesus Christ man at the well?
The lady, when he told her that even the husband, that she, the person she has, is not hers.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. He's without shin cast his first stone. Yes. Yeah, yes. Okay.
And now,
my biblical history is a little rusty.
But you got Dennis is helping me. That, because I know you ain't come wrong. You get into that. The fact remains that I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
All the talk about projects of water authority, I was so released when I heard they were speaking in terms of the amount of land that they're going to put back into production. And they said, the minister said that they found a well at Rapeview. So that would assist with the watering of the products.
Mm-hmm.
You would recall I said that if Water Authority open up these wells, I was saying this on this radio for years, open up these wells that were used by sugar factory, water would not be a problem. Now, when there was a guy from St. George, a farmer, who spoke about how much water he gets from a well to feed his cows, because the cows use a lot of water. Now, if you know St. George very well, and I want Raul coming on this, if you know St. George very well, Paul Davis was the name that was used with David Ellis. If he could collect so much water from an old well at Walker's, and with so much plantations in St. George, if you pass St. George, you pass by Brighton, you go across by Carmichael, and you see the amount of water that is being used to water the plants and the vegetables and such like, and along with Buckley Factory. What is wrong with having water supply open back at these wells where those old engineers put down in this country to supply the sugar industry in more than one way? One, at the factories, you had to use water for steam engines to cool the engines.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you had to use water at the estate to feed the mules and donkeys.
But the question, no, I'm hearing you, but what I'm trying to understand is the supply of water, which is the same point you made last week. My understanding is that all of these wells that you're talking about are drawn from the same aquifers that the minister has come repeatedly said are extremely low.
No. They are using these aquifers as, just put me.
But in the question of they're using it, if it is that the aquifers, you go ahead.
You could remember during the knocking down or the proposed knockdown of the National Insurance Building, people calling and say one of the reasons why it should knock down, that water was coming up through the foundation. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the
building. That's what I heard, yeah.
The building is knocked down. I would like the engineers that knocked down the building to find out the building is knocked down, what part of the water is coming up. And if it is coming up, then for the building, it should be still coming up. You agree with me? No, the building is knocked down.
But I know. But what's the relevance at that point, though? The
relevance about that if water is coming up then, and all the time you had aquifers.
Yeah, and but that can't be. Sir, the National Insurance Building is right next to the sea.
I know that you're very fair.
No, but sir, the National Insurance Building is right next to the sea.
But that's why I am telling you, I tell that no, don't mind where it is. I want to see where the water is coming up. That is what I want to see.
Right.
I want to go into that.
Sir, let me move on, because I can't argue that. Look, I am not an engineer, but I know that the issue of water and the level of the water is basically one that engineers have spoken on, and they've said that generally speaking, the aquifers now are at a lower level.
But this is the point that if the aquifers are the same aquifers,
mm-hmm.
why it is that engineer and those days.
Apparently, this building that we are in, the Starcom building, has similar challenges.
Let me finish.
It's right on a river.
It's a simple thinking. Mm-hmm. If the water wells were at the same aquifers, why would you choose different here is to put them a water in and then put them a water in any place. That's the question. It has to be a reason that these people put them water in at certain points.
Sir,
if your argument is that aquifers are the same aquifers, you won't have to go all about. Go up in St. Philip, I keep mentioning it. Go up in St. Philip and see you have water. There's one behind the one another. But they put the water, they dig the oil, and put all into one tank. What I am saying that in the St. George area, these wells could be used and then store the water and transfer them to either...
Yeah, but you're operating on the assumption that the wells having water that can be tapped.
They're having water.
All right, no problem.
All of those wells.
All right. Next time we have the minister or we have the gentleman from the Water Authority on, I can let you call in and you can discuss that with them. Because I am comfortable with their analysis of our water supply underground, where it is plentiful and where it is short. And I am comfortable with the argument that they have given me that the levels of the aquifers across the country are lower, and as a result, there's less water they can suck from them.
But I am not comfortable.
You're not comfortable, which is fine. So we leave it at that. I am, you're not.
I'm saying this to you.
What's the other point that you wanted to make, sir?
Let me finish the last point.
Sure.
The same way that, as I said, and I can't remain speaking on this card, the truth does not change. Don't care what corner you go wrong, the truth remains the same. If Porter's old factory well is still being used to supply Portland Sugar Factory, which is a new sugar factory. You want to tell me that those wells by those old engineers, those old people that developed this country and understand the reason why they put those wells in those areas? Don't let nobody fool you, Peter. Peter, keep blowing your own trumpet. Think for yourself. Mm. And I'm telling you that all the engineers in this country is doing with old people is making old people look foolish. Andrews, I grew up. They used to tell you that you couldn't get water because of the work of the Andrews Factory. I said, Joseph's people were suffering that. Andrews Factory shut down a long time ago. And this is Joseph's people going through the same problem.
Well, all I say is that I have a lot of sympathy for people who work as engineers, because you study for a long time to become an engineer, and then you put forward theories which you are using based on evidence you have gathered. And then you have people who are in the, essentially on the ground that will tell you they're talking foolishness. And no amount of evidence can convince them differently. I have a similar challenge. I study politics. And I've studied politics for a long time, and I usually reason with the benefit of certain evidence that I have gathered. And then I would have people who are, on the ground in constituencies at the time, they're talking foolishness. And that is life. So as I said, sir, I respect your right to disagree with the engineers. I am always more comfortable with an engineering opinion than I am with an opinion of someone that says that because there was a well that had in water 25 years ago, it should still got in water. No. But we can agree to disagree on that. Somebody is asking me if we are living on a different island and if there are aquifers in St. Lucia. I'm not sure the point that is being made, but this is what the WhatsApper is saying. Good morning, Mr. Wickham. I just wanted to mention this. Yesterday, I was waiting for the 2:00 City Circle bus to the City Center Mall, or at the City Center Mall. Four elderly ladies were there. Would you believe a KFL bus came up and stopped for a lady, and the City Circle was coming around and did not even stop. I was walking towards it, behind the KFL bus, hands outstretched. The driver just drove straight. These elderly ladies were so annoyed. My heart felt sad for them. I don't understand what. I reported it, but the lady that answered said the complaint officers were not there. I called Weymouth. If my hands were not filled with shopping, I would have taken out the phone to take him on video. It was so disrespectful to those ladies. So I think what happened is that the City Circle bus driver did not stop behind the KFL bus to notice or to see whether there were people coming up or not. And I think that was unfortunate. So I would agree entirely with that assessment that it is unfortunate. There are some countries where buses stop at every bus stop regardless. And I've often wondered whether that might not be a good policy for us to adopt. That regardless of whether or not someone puts out their hand, they just stop. Years ago, a friend of mine from the United States told me that she came to Barbados and she stood along the south coast waiting for a bus. And she was standing with her hands at her side because she assumed that when the bus saw there was someone at the bus stop, they would stop. She said that she was there for the better part of 45 minutes as several buses passed her until a lady came to the bus stop and said, but if you want the bus, you got to push out your hand. And then she realized the challenge. So, yeah, that's something that we can perhaps learn from.